Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. This week, we will dive into Libya, now more than 10 years after the death of Muammar Gaddafi, in a divided Libya, littered with a patchwork of rebel groups vying for power. Only one thing is unanimous by international observers. This North African country is a failed state. So just how did a once thriving society go from this to this in just a matter of a decade? We'll discuss with a former U.S. diplomat to Africa. All right, let's get into the MO. Thousands of armed rebels, major cities in ruins, open slave trade happening on the streets. The rule of law no longer exists in this fractured country destroyed by NATO bombings in 2011. Now, it began as three separate colonies, Cyrenaica, Tripolitania, and Fezzan under the Ottoman Empire. But today, we know it simply as Libya. After World War II, a sort of guardianship was granted to the UK and France. Soon after, the UNGA granted independence and unification of all those three regions. But its independence, however, came at a cost. The agreement that Western-friendly King Idris come into power in 1951. Now, Idris allowed the US and UK to build military bases in the country in exchange for economic aid. For the Americans' part, they gave about 100 million US dollars to Idris, which was a lot of money at that time, especially for a country that was rather impoverished. But it wouldn't be long before Libya discovered it wasn't poor at all. As it turns out, Libya was sitting on one of the richest oil fields in the world, and certainly the biggest reserves in Africa at the time. The year was 1959. The Nasser wells hit liquid black gold. Back then, it was called Amal and Zeltan. But in just two short years, Libya was an oil exporter. Now this, after oil exploration had turned out dry since 1915. So let's fast forward 10 years to 1969. Now, there's a saying about jobs in management, right? That when you finally get to go on vacation, that's when anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And that's exactly what happened to King Idris of the Kingdom of Libya. While Idris was on holiday in Turkey, but some argue he was actually seeking medical treatment there, a young army officer led a bloodless coup d'etat deposing King Idris in 1969. That officer was Muammar Gaddafi. Now, when General Gaddafi came to power, despite Libya's vast oil wealth, little had been done for the general public in the way of education, health care, and even basic living standards. Back then, only about 250,000 Libyans were actually literate of the estimated 4 million people of the country. The majority of Libyans lived well below the UN poverty line, and many were dying of curable diseases. In one generation under Gaddafi's rule, the nationalizing of the country's oil industry drove the literacy rate up to 88.4%, brought Libyan life expectancy up to 74 and a half years, and a number of other positive indicators as measured by the UN Development Program in 2010, just a year before his ouster and death. They called Libya a, quote, high development country in the Middle East and North Africa. So in the early 2000s, Libya had the highest GDP per capita and life expectancy on the entire African continent. And percentage against population actually had similar numbers to poverty in the Netherlands. I mean, it sounds pretty good, right? Especially compared to present day. But let's be clear about something. Gaddafi wasn't all kumbaya and rainbows and lollipops. He led his country as an authoritarian leader does, with an iron fist that came crashing down on anyone who got out of line. Political opposition, free speech, all of that. Iron fist. Now, Gaddafi had a lot of grand ideas, though. Chief among them, building tight bonds with the Arab world and unifying Africa, even before there was an African Union. He wanted a joint gold-based dinar currency. He put Libya in OPEC. But he also liked to fund rebel groups and what some would say terror campaigns. Take, for example, the 1988 bombing of the Pan Am jet over Lockerbie, Scotland, killing all 259 people on board and 11 more on the ground. The UN subsequently imposed sanctions on Libya in 1992. They later removed them in 2003 after Libya formally accepted responsibility for that tragedy. Libya had to pay $2.3 billion in compensation for their role in international terrorism. But then, staving off the Arab Spring in neighboring Tunisia and Egypt in 2011, the discontent found its way into Libya. Aided by U.S.-led NATO, a bombing campaign ensued in aid of Gaddafi's opposition. The seven-month campaign ripped the core of the country apart, displacing some 2 million of its residents, causing death in the thousands. Now, multiple factions of rebel groups, all claiming authority over territory. By all international accounts, Libya is a failed state. For his perspective, we'll talk to a man who actually knew Muammar Gaddafi. He spent decades as a career diplomat, retiring in 1993 as the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Ambassador Herman Cohen is now the president of Cohen Woods International, an advisement group on African and Mideast business development. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us. First, can you describe for us physically what Libya actually looked like in the 40 years under Muammar Gaddafi? I mean, what was life like for the average Libyan there?
Well, I think the life was pretty good in Libya. There was plenty of money coming in from oil, and they could consume consumer goods. So I think it was significantly above the poverty level for the average Libyan. And there wasn't much involvement in politics. Gaddafi just controlled everything. So they weren't asked to vote on anything or to have referendum or anything like that. They said, keep out of politics. Gaddafi said, I'll run everything. And he made sure that they had a high standard of living.
Now, historically, how would you describe the U.S. position on Libya?
Well, you know, for many years, we had a U.S. air base in Libya. And this was what we were planning to use in case we needed to intervene in the Middle East or in Africa. And so that was our highest priority. And as long as the Libyan government didn't bother us, we didn't bother them, we just operated our air base and did exercises there.
How would you characterize the U.S.-Libya relationship for all those years prior to Gaddafi's death?
Well, I wouldn't call it friendly. Actually, it was not friendly after Gaddafi organized a terrorist attack in Berlin. There was a U.S. Army social club there, and he organized a terrorist attack against the Americans, and there were some Americans killed. So at that point, the United States became very hostile to Gaddafi, and we bombed his home. We sent the U.S. Air Force planes from England to bomb his home, and there was a death. There was a death of Gaddafi's adopted child, and this caused him to be very, very angry at the United States. And from that point, relations were quite bad.
Now, under Barack Obama, we saw the fall of Gaddafi and ultimately his brutal demise. This came after a U.S.-led NATO intervention in the country. We know President Obama made references to democracy, dictatorship, violence, and so on. However, at one point on the issue of Libya, President Obama said, quote, "We must always measure our interests against the need for action." So what exactly is or was the interest in Libya?
Well, in Libya, we want to make sure that the flow of oil continues. Libya is a major producer of crude oil, and if that is interrupted, then the international markets are troubled, and prices go up and that sort of thing. I would say that that is currently our main interest in Libya. And also we want to make sure that sub-Saharan Africa remains stable. And Libya has a lot of impact on what goes on in sub-Saharan Africa. For example, in southeast Libya, there are major arms deposits there in warehouses. And this is an area called Fezzan. And currently, terrorists in the Sahel countries, are Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. Terrorists attacking those countries are getting their arms from southern Libya in the place called Fezzan. So Libya has an impact on what goes on in the rest of Africa. And we want Libya to be a stable country that's looking to maintain peace and stability in all of Africa.
Muammar Gaddafi actually played an outsized role in shaping modern-day OPEC methodology. How would you describe his efforts? I mean, was he, you know, a guy that was basically trying to unionize these Arab oil countries? Or do you think it was something else? Was there something nefarious? How would you describe it?
Well, his first objective, he was a man for unity in the sense that he wanted to have all countries in the Middle East to become part of Libya. He wanted a large federation of which Libya, he, Gaddafi, would be the head of it. So he approached Syria. He wanted to have the Syria Arab Union join Libya, and he was rejected. Everyone said, no, we don't want to join Libya. So that got him very angry at the Arabs. I remember him telling me after that, he says, I'm not an Arab anymore, I'm an African. He says, I'm gonna have unity with the Africans. And he proposed to have an African Union before there was an African Union. He proposed African Union, in which he would of course be the head. And because he had a lot of money, he was inviting a lot of African leaders to come visit him. And he had the president of Mali, he had the president of Niger, he had the president of Angola. They all came to visit him. They were very happy to do that. And he kept proposing, let's have an African Union. We'll become one country. But none of them wanted to do that. And that was very frustrating for him. And so he sent his own troops to northern Chad. There's a strip of land in the north of Chad that has an air base. And he sent troops and occupied it. It was called the Uzu Strip. And he said, well, we'll now have unity with Chad. And he was using that air base to bomb other countries. Like he sent bombers to bomb Khartoum in Sudan, see, because they refused to join his union. So he was very aggressive. He was very aggressive, and he wanted to be the leader. He wanted to be the leader of all of Africa. If he couldn't be the leader of all the Arab countries, he could be the leader of all of Africa. But of course, the Africans didn't want to join him, and he was very frustrated.
Can you expand for us on this Libya and his dreams of this big oil monopoly?
Yes. Well, they had to join OPEC in order to make sure they get the prices that that they wanted and that they could influence OPEC. I don't remember how many barrels a day they were exporting. I think it was about a million. And he could influence the price of oil, and he wanted to make sure that the price of oil was maximum because he wanted all that currency.
All right, Ambassador Cohen has agreed to stick around to unpack more about the situation in Libya, and we'll also get his analysis on modern-day diplomacy, or I would say lack thereof. We will discuss it when we return with Ambassador Cohen. Sit tight, the MO will be right back.
Is your media a reflection of reality? In a world transformed, what will make you feel safer? Isolation or community? Are you going the right way or are you being led somewhere? Which direction? What is truth? What is fake? In a world corrupted, you need to descend. So join us in the depths or remain in the shallows.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
And welcome back to the MO. We are again joined by Ambassador Herman Cohen. Thank you for staying with us, Mr. Ambassador, as we continue this discussion about Libya. So Libya has this sort of interesting, varied role in the world. It's both part of the Arab world. It's also part of the African world, which Gaddafi sought to really develop with this whole African Union idea, even a gold-based currency for the continent, similar to the EU with the euro. Did that dream die with Gaddafi, or could we see something like that come to fruition maybe in the future?
Well, it died with Gaddafi, but it already exists. For example, all of the French-speaking countries that used to be French colonies, they have a common currency. It's called the CFA, and it's backed by the French treasury. So it's a hard currency. And you can use a CFA to import anything from any place in the world, because if you pay off in CFA, everybody's happy with that. It's backed by gold, so they're coming close to a common currency. But having all of Africa in a common currency, that has never been really discussed, but except by Gaddafi himself. But it's never been realized. Gaddafi, I might mention right now that Gaddafi believed in revolution. He says, I support rebels all over the world. And he had a couple of adventures outside of Africa. For example, in Northern Ireland, when the Northern Ireland War was going on against the UK, I forgot when that ended, about 10 years ago, he supported rebels in Northern Ireland. He supported the Catholic rebels in Northern Ireland. He sent them money. He sent them arms. And secondly, in the Philippines, I believe it was the Philippines, there was a rebellion going against the Philippine government in the island of Mindanao. And he sent arms to the rebels in Mindanao, who happened to be Muslims. He said, these Muslims are being oppressed in Mindanao by the Philippine government. I'm going to help them. And he did. He sent them money. So he had this concept of revolution is good. Revolution is good, and I'm going to support revolutionaries all over the world. And he had these two adventures, one in Northern Ireland and one in the Philippines.
Now, there are also a lot of external forces at play in Libya. The last estimates by the UN put around 30,000 foreign fighters in the country as of 2021. Now, beyond the U.S., there is Russia, there's Turkey, the Egyptians are there, the UAE. Why so much foreign interest in this country? What's on the table in Libya that all these other nations, including the U.S., wish to exert, I don't know, maybe influence or even control over its future?
Well, you know, Libya, ever since Gaddafi's death, has not had a unified government. It's had really two governments. You have one in the eastern province of Cyrenaica, and you had another government in Tripoli, in the western province of Tripolitania. And there was nothing in the southern province of Fezzan. It's just sort of local local control. So everyone is worried. The Egyptians who have the border with Libya, they are worried that the instability in Libya will spill over into Egypt. And the Turks feel that they have an interest in protecting Turkish interests, which is they're buying oil from Libya. So, and since there was no real government in Libya, they had one government in eastern Libya and another government in Tripoli, everyone said it's basically a failed state. So we want to make sure that the Libyan entity remains stable. And the only one to do that, the only way to do that is send troops. So you had the Turkish government send troops and the Egyptian and even the Russians, because the Russians sent mercenaries there who are looking to make money. See, the mercenaries come and said, oh, we will protect you. But their real interest is to make money. See, so Libya is still today basically a failed state. It's really not a modern government.
Today, many have called Libya a failed state. I mean, you yourself just assigned it that label. Can you expand a little bit more on that for us?
I think it was basically Gaddafi. He did not want a strong state. He didn't want a parliament. He didn't want local governors and that sort of thing. He was afraid that he would be overthrown if there was people with guns and people with authority in the rest of Libya. So he maintained it that way. Let me give you an example of one thing that happened. I had a meeting with him, a private meeting with him, and he said, I have something that will interest you, Mr. Cohen. And I said, what is that? He said, I've invited the Jewish people to come back to Libya. You know, before he came to power, there was a king, the King Idris, who was living in eastern Libya. And when the Palestine thing blew up, when the state of Israel was established, a lot of African countries expelled all their Jews. And so did Libya. The king, not Gaddafi, the King Idris, he expelled the Libyans, Jewish people, who were mainly Italians. You know, because Libya started out as an Italian colony. So where did these people go? Half of them went to Italy, and half of them went to Israel. So Gaddafi, and then of course they took a lot of their money out. So Gaddafi, in a private conversation with me, said, this will interest you, Mr. Cohen. I'm inviting all the Libyan Jewish people to come back. I said, oh, that's wonderful, terrific. And he actually did that. He sent emissaries to Rome, to Israel, and he said, please come back. So maybe a year later, I was visiting. I didn't talk to Gaddafi. I talked to one of his high-ranking people. In fact, he had an institute called the Institute for the Green Book. You know, like Mao Zedong had a red book. He had a green book with his sayings in there. So I went to the head of the Institute for the Green Book. It turned out I had made friends with him. I said, well, what happened? Did the Jews come back? He said, yeah, a lot of them came back. I said, what happened? He said, they sold all their property and left again. So that was their only interest, was to make sure they get their money and they didn't want to live there, you see. And it turned out that Gaddafi's wife was an Italian Jewess. And what she was doing is taking Gaddafi's money and sending it to good causes in Israel. And I'm sure he didn't know anything about it. But anyway, he had an interesting encounter, but it's too bad because the Jewish people who were in Libya, the Italian Jewish people, you know, they were doing industry and that sort of thing. So Libya lost all of that entrepreneurial spirit that they had brought.
Now, on your many decades in public service, you are what's called a career diplomat. Can you share with us what you've learned about dealing with foreign leaders?
Well, to be a successful diplomat, you first have to understand who the other guys are. You know, if you get sent to a country, you have to understand who are they, what motivates them, and you know, where are the different power structures in the country. And as I look back on my career, I think I spent 3/4 of my time asking questions, always asking questions of people, you know, local officials, local dignitaries, because I wanted to know who these people are, what motivates them, so that I could recommend policies to Washington, policy should be. And so it's mainly a question of understanding. Also, we have archives about these countries. You know, every embassy, every American embassy sends back reports. This is what's going on this week in the country. So before you even go out, you look at all these reports from previous diplomats in that country. That gives you knowledge about how things are going. And also you want to make contacts, not just with the government. You want to talk to people in the press. You want to talk to people in cultural organizations. For example, the National Association of Women. You want to talk to them. You want to talk to youth, National Association of Libyan Youth or Nigerian youth, and that sort of thing. You want to talk to opposition political parties. You just don't want to talk to the party in power, you see. So it's a question of getting around and asking questions. That's the best way to be a diplomat.
Ambassador Herman Cohen, thank you so much for sharing all of that insight with us today.
Thanks for interviewing me. I appreciate it.
While there is so much chaos in Libya right now, so many loud external voices, let's not forget to listen to the softer speakers, those of the average Libyan civilian who, by and large, only wish for peace, stability, and sovereignty. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I am your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.